Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulist Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And with us this week, we have Joshua Miller. He's a leader in the field of narrative-based motivational assessment. For the last 18 years, he's applied his expertise in a variety of applications, including executive search, organizational development, and talent management. His longstanding desire to understand and help people develop their unique giftedness led to an MA and PhD in philosophy of the human person. He continues to effectively integrate learning from this study into his coaching and consulting practices. Joshua also helped build the Center for Leadership at Franciscan University of Steubenville, where he currently serves as a vocation coach and vocation coach trainer for faculty and staff of the institution. He is co-founder of InScape with Luke Burgess, and we're going to talk today about their new book, Unrepeatable, Cultivating the Unique Calling of Every Person. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks very much, Pete. It is a privilege to be with you here.
Oh, well, it's great to have you in a wonderful book, and I can't wait to dig in. So let's get started here. Your book centers around what we're experiencing somewhat in this crisis of vocations. And how bad is this crisis?
I think that the crisis of vocations is something that strikes not simply at the heart of people responding to the priesthood and religious life or the call to marriage, but really a problem of folks in general not grappling with the question of who am I called to be before God and how am I called to be holy. So it goes beyond what we often hear about when we hear of crisis and vocations. Folks often think about a lack of priests and religious. Mm-hmm. But it's really a lack of understanding of the unique calling that God gives to every person to live holy for him.
Exactly. So in your experience and your study and everything that you do, what do you believe has led us to this point where people are confused as to what their vocation roles are?
Yeah, it's so much to say on that, Pete. I think that I mean, one easy way to start, I believe, is that at least in a Catholic context, in the context of parish and family life, we still tend to think about vocation as it relates to the priesthood and religious life. For example, if I were to say to you that I think my son has a vocation, you'd be expected to understand by that he's called to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Or in our parishes, when we pray for vocations, we're expected to pray for priests and religious. And I don't want to sound negative on that, because there is this profound gift, sacramental gift of the church, without which the church could not be, through the sacramental gift of the priesthood. But the Second Vatican Council, years and years ago, instructed the faithful about each one's call to holiness, the call of the laity to sanctify the world, and really the importance of each person to understand who he or she is in Christ and the calling associated with that. And I just think that we have failed in multiple ways to grow a Catholic understanding of the unique call for every person. I think there's a variety of reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to keep rambling.
Oh, you're not rambling at all. It's a fascinating topic. So how can your book Unrepeatable help re-energize the base, so to speak? What's your thoughts behind what the book can do?
So in his very first encyclical to the church, a heartfelt letter to the church when he first became pope in 1978, John Paul II wrote, and this is encyclical The Redeemer of Man, he writes very strongly about the need for each person to be the way of the church. And in section 21 of that document, he talks about how true renewal in the church depends upon that initiative being grounded in each one's personal vocation, each one's own calling. So he spoke about authentic renewal being grounded in personal vocation, and I think anybody who's attuned to what's happening in the church now is going to realize that we are in a moment of serious decline. You know, when 50 or more percent of young people leave the church after confirmation or after high school, that is a major, major problem. And
right.
So one of the ways to tackle that, though, is by cultivating each one's calling in some of the ways we talk about in the book.
So you talk about in the book, knowing the culture around us and the challenges it presents to us, and you discuss these areas, and I'd like to cover them. The first being that we live in a culture of calculation. What exactly is that, a culture of calculation, as you described it?
Absolutely. So we live in a culture where, in order to make decisions, we want to figure things out exactly, according to the data, according to the facts. Luke shares a story of a bachelor CEO that he knows. And in a conversation about marriage, the call to marriage, Luke asked this person, we'll call him Tommy, how about marriage, Tommy? And Tommy said, well, if you could tell me without a shadow of a doubt that I would be more happy if I was married, then I would pursue marriage. If you can't, then I won't. And so this desire to only move forward if we can be exactly sure on the basis of calculation keeps us back, I think, from taking the kind of plunge that we often need to take with vocation in response to call. So that's one thing, is that we tend to think according to the left brain, according to logical analysis. And when we're considering a response to God's call, this dynamic daily call, as well as the large life decisions, we have to move beyond calculation into what we talk about in the book as a culture of wonder. You know, we wonder at things, we dwell in things, we ought to anyhow, rather than simply calculate exactly next steps.
It's kind of interesting in that section where you're talking about the culture of calculation is we all have this inherent desire to succeed, and it's actually blown up into this whole market of life hacking products that have become so popular to help us achieve that. Why do you think that has become such a prominent area these days?
So I would like to answer that by looking at another cultural issue that we address in the book, and that is this culture of disincarnation. Mm-hmm. So if we live in a digital world where the options are almost limitless, and a globalized world where, you know, next week I could be in Thailand if I wanted to, mm-hmm. or I could be down in New York City working with the homeless. So because of our globalized digital world, we have a myriad of options. And because of that, we are faced with anxiety about who we are and what to do next. And so I think part of that life hacking emphasis is because of this disincarnate world where we live in virtual reality oftentimes with a myriad of options. And when we are grounded in the flesh and blood reality of being in a particular place, particular relationships, and a particular call to those within our place, then some of the needs that are around us, which beckon to us, just responding to those become a response to God's call. And there's less anxiety, I think.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting, the globalization of the world that you described there and the the use of electronics and whatnot, it's actually sheltered us from people.
Right.
Even though we get this false sense of community, it's really not community at all.
I agree entirely.
So,
yeah, I agree entirely.
What can we do to overcome that in your experience, have you found would be helpful?
So when I work with young people, I taught a class last fall on discerning personal vocation, and Luke and I are building a personal vocation training as well. But one of the things that we do there is we simply have people encounter one another face-to-face, so holding conversation with one another, understanding that the communication between persons is richest when it takes place in a one-on-one face-to-face encounter where we can read body language, we can hear tone of voice. And when we share story with one another about deeply engaging activities, then those become moments where we provide the experience of authentic empathy, authentic encounter, where we listen to the other. And in really listening to the other, we have to have our own self-possession. We have to be grounded in ourselves and our own interiority. And we can then better listen to ourselves as well as we learn how to listen to one another. So I think those are really critical opportunities for us to grow in authentic face-to-face encounter and the authentic discernment that emerges from that.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll dive more into this. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way: buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land gift shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today with us, we have Joshua Miller, co-author of Unrepeatable, Cultivating the Unique Calling of Every Person. And last segment, Josh, we were talking about the culture calculation, and we touched upon disincarnation. You call it a crisis of fake wood. Can you explain that analogy there to us a bit?
Crisis of fake wood. Yes. So when we encounter things that are fake, it's difficult to wonder at them because we understand that they are a production of something according to industrial manufacturing specifications. And so it's pretty, like when we have on our laptops the screen of a nice, lovely forest of trees. It's pretty and engages us, but it doesn't evoke wonder. And when we surround ourselves with things that are fake, that we know are produced according to precise manufacturing specs, it doesn't draw out this encounter with the designer behind those. When we walk in the forest or when we look upon the face of another human person, when we encounter them in their poverty or their wealth, they just have a real encounter with them, then we are faced with something that is real and that also gets us closer to the designer behind that reality. And there's much more of a palpable sense of mystery that we can enter into, and which we really have to do that for a couple reasons. And this is really important with human persons. One is that in order for people to know that they are loved and affirmed, they need to be really gazed upon by another person. And we have to dwell with one another. And when, for example, we look upon another with empathy or we hear their story as they share it, and they recognize that they are loved and appreciated for the unique mystery that they are, that sets up a context where they can grow deeper in understanding of who they are and appreciation. It gives confidence, and it enables people to kind of grow towards the light of the loving warmth that we give them. I hope I'm not speaking too abstractly, but it's really important for people to be encountered that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, it also kind of stretches our own muscles and helps us to encounter people as God calls us to do. And that's really important.
Right, right. You also talk about a culture of conformity, and this quote from the book struck me, and it goes, quote, "Our culture celebrates the free, autonomous self, yet we have a stultifying lack of differentiation," end quote. Kind of odd, yeah. Isn't that?
Absolutely odd. It's interesting. So in this particularly American context, we have folks that, as you said, quoting from the book, you know, we celebrate autonomy and individuality, et cetera. When we do that in a digital context where, you know, we draw upon images that we pull from, you know, from Google or snippets of rock songs, you know, that we pull as well, and then use those to express individuality, what we're doing is, again, we're drawing upon mass-produced things that our culture feeds to us, rather than growing or being appreciated in our own unique personhood. And so there's a stultifying lack of originality when that's how we approach self-growth and social interaction. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And sad.
Yeah, for sure. So again, you focused on the central theme of individuals and their uniqueness. We touched upon that a little while ago, but I'd like to go just a little deeper in that. Why is it so important for us to focus on that uniqueness?
So this, I think, is very critical. One of the things that John Paul II said before his pontificate in a letter to Henri de Lubac is that a fundamental problem of our age is the pulverization of the uniqueness of each person. And when we think about that, and then we think about the meaning of love, I think there's a close connection here. When Christ loves us, he doesn't think of us in general, generic terms. He thinks of us according to our name, according to the original design that he gave to us and he calls us to fulfill in self-created freedom. So if we know that that's how Christ loves, and we know that we are to love as God does, then that's how we have to treat one another. And so insofar as we treat one another just as men or as women or as Americans or as liberal or as Orthodox, then we're really missing the person. So it's really essential for us to see one another as unique persons, living in community, living for God in mission, but to cultivate that person in their uniqueness is, I think, an act of profound love for the person, which is what we ought to be about on this earth.
Right. Another area you sort of dig into in the book is motivational design. For those who haven't read
Yes.
the book, what exactly is motivational design?
So it's essentially that each person is crafted by God, is designed by God, and because God himself is love, we find in ourselves certain innate drives to love a certain way. So motivational design really is this way that we've been given to love in the world. And we see it particularly in young kids. I'm a father of six. My wife, Brooke, and I have six children. And when they emerge into the world very early on, they just have this passionate impulse to be a certain way and do things a certain way. And it's this innate, intrinsic, motivational drive, let's call it. You know, and it's connected with natural talent, with personality, of course. But it's a kind of underlying motivational drive for us to be and do a certain way. That's essentially what we mean. But it's really important to understand because it is a primordial vocation. If God crafts us with a certain motivational design, it's almost like a soul's code, let's say, very comparable to the genetic code, then that's got to be factored into discernment of who he wants us to be, who's calling us to be and to do in this world.
All right. So as you move through the book, you discuss Arthur Miller and what you refer to as achievement stories.
Yeah.
What's the key to achievement stories, why they're important, and then secondly, how do we draw those out of people?
Yeah, thank you so much for these questions, Pete. They're just excellent. So I've been working with people for over 20 years in terms of understanding their unique patterns of motivation. Very, very seldom are people asked to reflect about, to talk about activities in their lives that they've deeply enjoyed doing and believe they've done well. And that's how we define an achievement story. It's not achievement in terms necessarily of contemporary success or, you know, meeting some conventional standard of success, but really, what does a person enjoy doing and believe they do well? That's the achievement story. So the reason why it's so critical to get out from people is that when they share those stories, they are sharing moments of their motivational design in action. And that's very joy-filled for them. It's very fulfilling for them. And so it gives them this experience of being affirmed and appreciated in action that's been very, very authentic to them, very unique to them. Mm-hmm. So that's the first piece of this, I guess.
So the big question, and it's sort of the whole overarching theme of the book and the reason for it, is how do we go about being good mentors to youth?
Yes. Well, there's a number of ways to do this. One, I think, is that we need to take time to dwell with the young people, to take them seriously, to draw out those achievement stories that we just talked about. Very seldom are young people asked to share those stories. It's amazing to me. One of my roles at Franciscan is to train mentors. And as we work with youth, we recognize that they often haven't been asked to draw out these stories. So when we do so, it helps them to recognize that they have this unique innate pattern of motivation, which is critical. They see connections between these joyful activities, but also the contribution that they can offer up with the kinds of things that those activities have been about. So that's very critical. I think that helping them recognize that they already have a calling is really, really important. That calling is not something that's simply related to a state in life, but because they're baptized, you know, assuming that those who are mentoring are baptized, they already called to make a unique contribution. And when we can help them see that they do that, they can do that, it's very, very affirming and life-giving to them. So those are a few ideas for how we can effectively mentor the young people under our care.
What exactly are the keys to success to making all that happen?
I think that it's easy for us to get overwhelmed particularly in the digital age when most of us have 30, 40, 50 emails coming in every day. But when we just take seriously the people that we're given to take care of, take time with them, listening to them, asking them reflective questions, those are absolutely key. Dwelling with the people under our care, asking them questions which draw them out to be reflective, and then listening with deep empathy. All of that creates really magical moments of mentorship where they can recognize that they're loved by the mentor and start to see connections in terms of the questions that we ask them.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to discuss 7 keys for guiding effective discernment. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
May I share a personal story with you? My 8-year-old daughter was, let's just say, not on her best behavior, as happens sometimes with our children, because they're normal. The next morning, I said to her, "Should you ever behave that way again, I will still love you. I'll always love you. There is nothing you can ever do to make me stop loving you." She melted, smiled, and gave me a beautiful hug. This caused me to think, isn't this how our Heavenly Father deals with us, His beloved children? I wish I could tell you that I always interact with my children in this good way, but I often fail. But what a sublime thing it is when we can mirror our faithful Heavenly Father's unconditional forgiving love and mercy. I'm Jim Littleton, forming faithfulfamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We're spending the day with Joshua Miller, co-author of Unrepeatable, Cultivating the Unique Calling of Every Person. And Josh, chapter 6 to me was a big one. And in that chapter is where you lay out the 7 keys for guiding effective discernment. And I'd like to spend some time in this segment and probably spill over into the next one to cover each of those and sort of pick your brain a little bit of what they are. So the first one was to teach personal vocation.
Mm-hmm. So even though personal vocation is a church teaching, it's laid out in John Paul II's first encyclical. It's a dimension of his messages on World Youth Day. It's a part of his teaching about from a document called Christi Fidelis Laici on the lay vocation in the world. And there he says that key to formation of the lay person is cultivating in them an understanding of personal vocation in number 58. Even though this is church teaching, it's a peripheral concept. It's a peripheral concept in our Catholic schools, our colleges, our seminaries, and in the rhythm of Catholic life, you just don't hear about it a lot. So if our young people in particular, and adults as well, it's really not just young people, if we are to grow according to personal vocation and have that cultivated, we have to teach it. We have to teach it as a reality that vocation is not just a state in life, but rather a dynamic call each one has that encompasses every dimension of their life. So when we have that language, when we have that concept and reality as a part of our kind of grammar of living, then we can more deeply grow in an understanding of unique calling, both for ourselves and those under our care.
Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting comment there. And I like to kind of segue down that path a little bit here. It's probably just as productive for the mentee as it is for the mentor.
Yes.
Which I think
I think that's true.
Very interesting, because not only are we helping them grow, we're growing ourselves as we're going through this process, correct?
Very much so. Very much so. I can't tell you how many moms and teachers and catechists have said, look, what you're doing at InScape is not just about young people, and we really have to begin, frankly, more foundationally with the mentors themselves, because we can't give what we ain't got.
Right.
And when we're grounded in what it means to be uniquely called, what it means to understand our own patterns of motivation and to be self-aware in that, that's first. And then we can help those that we're mentoring. Because after all, the mentor is one who's been down the way before, and it's helping as a guide and a Sherpa.
Right.
For people under the care.
The second key you talk about in chapter six is to help mentees find their own way of discernment. And I think that's important. The verbiage of that sentence is the important part. We're not thrusting a vocation upon them. We're helping them determine what their vocation is.
Yes. So we're helping them to determine what their own vocation is, and we're honoring the unique path that they will need to go on in order to get there. So one of the stories that my co-author and friend Luke Burgess talks about is that when he was in seminary, he was in seminary for 5 years, he was in Rome at the North American College, but as he was there trying to discern deeply if he should be a priest, you know, of course, community prayer was important, individual prayer was important, of course, being grounded in the sacraments and daily mass was critical, but he also talks about, for him, if he neglected the kind of creativity that is a part of who he is, if he neglected that, if he neglected the kind of adventure spirit that he has, you know, going into Rome and checking things out, if he neglected that, then he would get a bit depressed and feel spiritually barren. So for him, he needed to keep up a lively creativity going as a part of just living out who he is in God. And then in those moments of creativity, he talks about thinking by doing, Luke does. And so that for him is a way of discernment. It's a way of figuring out the fit between a potential life as a priest and, you know, or not. So each of us has got to approach the Lord, and God approaches us, you know, in our own way. And we need to be sensitive to that as mentors rather than applying a kind of one-size-fits-all spiritual recipe for discernment.
Gotcha. The next key that you have is to explore the connection between talents and motivational design.
Yeah. Really critical. Sometimes we have a short-sighted recommendation that we provide to other people. So let's say we have a young person who's really, really good at mathematics, or let's say programming. We say, hey, you're really good at that. You ought to do that for a career, you know, a career being an important part of a personal vocation. Mm-hmm. And very, very often in my work as a coach for years, I see that that has happened. And that is that people see a talent and they kind of go for it, but they don't recognize the connection between that natural talent and an underlying motivational drive. So, for example, I work with several young people who are motivated to learn things and to demonstrate that they can do them, but then they want to move on to some other new area of exploration. So they have a variety of talents, and for them to be kind of locked into a specialty would be professionally difficult for them to do. So in coaching, what they came to is that they need to be moving professionally into an area where learning and demonstrating what they have learned is part of the ebb and tide of that particular profession. Mm-hmm. So you've got to get it at underlying motivational design in order to see where the kind of primordial impulse to be is in the person. If that's not too vague.
No, that's perfectly fine. And as we move through this chapter, we come to expose them to need and orient them to service, which essentially takes them out of looking at self and instead turning to others, correct?
Absolutely. One of the things that parents often do in our contemporary age is isolate kids from direct service. So we want to give our kids a great education and great experiences, so we provide them with schooling, we provide them with sports, we provide them with social opportunities, and service opportunities sometimes are sort of requirements that we check off the box. But they need to be deeply exposed to service, and they also need to recognize that when they engage in those acts of service, they really are making an authentic contribution. So we have got to awaken in our young people this awareness that they really do matter, that their contribution really, really matters, and that they are, that they're needed. And when they can experience the connection between doing things which really matter for people and how that draws them out, particularly when their gifts are drawn out and their motivational design is drawn out, those are moments of critical discernment for vocation.
You also talk about helping them secure wise, attentive mentors, and this is kind of just how I think, but that's kind of a risky proposition, because what if you're mentoring the mentee and they decide you're not a wise mentor?
Well, at Franciscan University, where I serve as a vocation coach trainer, what we do is we have students in the Center for Leadership program there go out to a pool of potential mentors and interview them and look for chemistry. So sometimes it's the case that they'll go from one person to the other, not because the one is not wise, but it's just personal chemistry. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that it's critical for us to help our young people ask the right questions of those that would mentor them. So oftentimes we gravitate towards celebrity figures or well-known figures, and this happens at a university setting, for example. Oftentimes those who are quiet and on the periphery, but who ask really good questions and cause reflection, make very, very good mentors. And so that's part of what we talk about in the book, is that we need to learn how to discern who's going to be right for me, who's going to be right for the person. And that's often just helping them ask the right questions and then interpret the experience that they have with others.
Mm-hmm. This next one I thought was rather interesting, considering some of the subject matter we talked about earlier and the type of world we're in and the noisy world around us, and that's cultivating prayerful silence and listening.
Mm-hmm. So I think that this is a cultural problem for just for all of us who live in the modern / postmodern age, and that is finding time for silence. So if we don't have that, then there's no way to properly discern the voice of the Lord, which is often that small, still quiet voice in our heart. So cultivating silence through a variety of means is absolutely critical. One of the things that I know a lot of folks do who are leading retreats, for example, or evenings of recollection, is to have us put our cell phones in boxes before we enter in. That's an important thing. I do think, too, it's important for us to get ourselves and those that we mentor out into the wild world of nature. I read a statistic that a lot of kids today spend less time outdoors than the average prison inmate. There's a study that shows that from 2016. And so I do think that the glories of nature help to evoke silence because of the beauty and power of it. And that's critical. It doesn't have to be, you know, Yellowstone National Park either. It can simply be going outside and sitting under a tree and appreciating the outside as a way to cultivate silence. And then, of course, going before our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament and just sitting there and waiting a half hour for the noise to just subside is absolutely critical.
Right. And to wrap up this segment and this chapter where we went through the seven keys for guiding effective discernment, Josh, the last one you had was awaken them to self-creative freedom.
Absolutely critical, Pete. One of the aha moments that I routinely have in teaching about personal vocation from young folks is this. We often think that response to vocation is about receiving a exact blueprint of action from the Lord and then acting upon it. But one of the gifts of personal vocation is the gift itself of self-created freedom. So there's a beautiful, beautiful passage from a letter that St. John Paul II wrote to the youth of the world. And he says this, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing. He says, you know, when we want to know the voice of the Lord, the young person will go to prayer, of course, will seek wise counsel, of course, will go to the church and look at the law of the church and what's happening in his or her own conscience, will recognize his or her own gifts as part of God's plan, will recognize the needs of the world that are present around that person. That's another feature of God's plan. And then that person, in prayer, decides, makes a decision, and acts. And in that decision is the will of God. So God delights, certainly, when we seek what he wants, but he also delights when, after deep prayer, we kind of go for it. And that becomes part of our calling. There's a wonderful quote along these lines from St. Joan of Arc, where she says, "Act, and God will act." So when we just kind of make a move, we can't be impulsive about this, but part of our personal vocation is being proactive. So when we recognize that and we move into the world and we make decisions and we kind of ship out and we go, and are confident in that, confident that God will use it, oh, it's liberating. It's a liberating thing that we don't have to sit around waiting for an exact blueprint.
Right on. We're going to take one more quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today with us, we've had Joshua Miller. He's a co-author with Luke Burgess of the book Unrepeatable, Cultivating the Unique Calling of Every Person. We've gone through that book the last three segments. There's also a companion workbook I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about, Josh, and that is Unrepeatable Life, the workbook, an 8-week program for discerning personal vocation. So to start, can you give us an overview of what that workbook and program are all about?
Yes. So we wanted readers to have more practical exercises for applying the book and the insights. So that's one thing, is that the workbook can be used as an accompaniment to the book itself. But also, and perhaps more of a focus was helping facilitators who are working with youth and young adults to have a course of action, a curriculum that they could use to take their own mentees through a robust process of personal vocation discernment. So the book itself is for mentors fundamentally, and then also people who are, younger folks who are trying to figure out who they are and what they're called to be. The workbook is for mentors to then take those insights with mentees. So it's cast for high school and college students. It's got that look and feel to it.
So if someone wanted to use this in the parish, how would they go about implementing this program at the parish level?
So we imagine a variety of things. We imagine an 8-week course, almost like an 8-week Bible study or a book study. That would be one thing that parish leaders could do. It could also be used in a youth group context. It could be used by small groups as well. I know this is a big phenomenon in evangelical Protestant circles to have small groups, but there are Catholic parishes as well where this is practiced, fellowship groups. And so we propose 8, probably 90-minute sessions, could be more than that. Mm-hmm. But we move from, well, just in practical, a practical orientation towards making a critical decision that relates to personal vocation, and then grappling with issues of discernment around that decision.
I think it's interesting in the beginning of the workbook, and I'll quote out of it. It says, since personal vocation is inherently social, we do recommend that those going through the workbook secure a companion.
Mm-hmm.
How is that helpful?
So it's helpful because we really come to know ourselves, and this is a general statement, we really come to know ourselves through others who can reflect to us what we're saying and what we're doing. You know, a sounding board, a companion, a friend who can reflect back to us a variety of things. This is important in the workbook for a couple of ways. One is to have this companion just pray for the person. You know, the Lord is very clear that where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. So when a person is grappling with the decision around personal vocation, when they have a companion who will pray, who will be there for them in a variety of ways, that's just helpful all around for discernment. One area where this is specifically useful is when we talk about the achievement story, as we did in the last couple of segments. Mm-hmm. And we have the companion literally ask open-ended reflective questions of various activities that the person has done that are vocational in nature, those achievement stories. So that's super helpful for the person going through the workbook to just hear themselves speak and to have what they say be reflected back to them from the companion. Very valuable for them making connections.
Right. I thought it's rather interesting in the workbook as we're talking about these achievement stories. You're not after something that's hugely grandiose by any means in these achievement stories. You say that basically as you're brainstorming them, it's simply something you did that, one, you believed you did well, two, you enjoyed doing, and or three, provided you with a sense of personal satisfaction. And one achievement story sample you give is becoming fluent in Spanish. So you're not actually looking for life-altering stories. It's just something that's an achievement that someone was proud of, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things, it's a critical concept, is that when things, we know what things are by how they act, by their behavior. And when we get people talking about those stories of achievements, they are representing action where they were just in the zone, in the flow, or in the salsa, as my friend Ron McNamara likes to say, from Franciscan. So when we represent those moments of action where we're just kind of immersed in doing something, it's like the part reveals the whole in one sense. The design of the person is expressed, even though, as you've said, they may not be these earth-shattering moments, but they're just really engaging for the person. And when they see a whole series of those stories, that's really valuable. So if a person shares a story from age 5 of building a model airplane, you know, with my dad and being immersed in the developmental steps of that, and then at age 12, they're building a tree fort, and then at age 15, they're building their own computer program, and they recognize that part of how they're designed is to enter into creative developmental process. They say, wow, you know, I'm doing the same kind of thing here, 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 and here. Then they see an intentionality of God's design. Mm-hmm. And some people in our experience have recognized God himself in that, you know, who weren't believers, they're atheists, and they saw an intentional designer in those stories. So really important for recognizing primordial vocation.
For sure. And something we haven't talked about yet, but it comes up here in the workbook after you have them go through and list and brainstorm these achievement stories, are what you refer to as core motivations, and you find them out as a result of recording these achievement stories.
Right. Yeah. So we need to give language as much as possible to the essential features of our motivational design, what we call core motivations. And sometimes language can conceal, you know, if we're using too blunt of a term, but we have the gift of language in order to draw things out, in order to see them clearly. So when a young person recognizes, or a mentor, that these consistent features of motivation can be named, then they start to have a grammar that they can use for thinking about next steps. Like, so for example, in the workbook, I talk about a student of mine, Rachel Michaud, and another person I coached, Benson Parker. As they shared their stories, certain essential things arose. So Benton Parker has been performing music and wanting to master music and then perform it from a very early age, you know, singing Elvis at age 8. Mm-hmm. So now he's in college working on a band. And so for him to be able to name some of those motivations around mastery and performance and associated motivational themes with being a singer-songwriter, let's say, mm-hmm. that's just been very important for him. And for Rachel as well, motivational themes around a longing to collaborate, to participate, to be a mentor for others as well as a leader. That's been very important for her.
Excellent. I got to tell you, we could keep going on and on, but we're pretty close to being out of time today, and I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find the book, where they can find the workbook, and where they can find your work as well.
Yeah, thank you. So if folks go to the InscapeVocations.com website, there's a store tab, and they can go there for purchasing both the book and the workbook. Another important thing is that Luke and I are developing a personal vocation mentor network. We're very, very interested in training people to be personal vocation mentors. And so we're offering that training. And actually, this July 26th, we are going to be beginning a series of webinars on this personal vocation mentor network. Awesome. So they can go to the website for more information about that. And I think that's really the place for people to start if they want to engage the work of InScape and learn more about our book and workbook.
Great. Well, Josh, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule and going over this cultivation of the unique calling of every person today. Any closing thoughts?
Simply that I believe very much that renewal and a deep expression of God's love is grounded in cultivating the personal vocation of other people. And it doesn't have to be rocket science, but simply when we draw others out with the right kinds of questions and listen to their story and love them with deep empathy, those are all the ingredients for fostering personal vocation. And we need to do that with those that God has given to us to care for.
Great stuff. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger here on Breadbox Media. And until next time, God bless.